Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. 60% of Australians are either obese or overweight.
We bang on about the obesity epidemic. Many people think that it's just a matter of willpower. People just can't stop eating and it's weak will and poor character that causes the obesity epidemic.
Whereas there's a solid body of evidence to suggest that actually what's happening here is an industry selling us low-value calories that are cheap and that make people put on weight. One source of these calories is sugar, and another is fat. And people have been suggesting that you should put a tax on sugar in some foods, and particularly in soft drinks. And other people are talking about a fat tax as well. In this episode of the Health Report, one of the highlights of the past year, we convened a group of public health experts to discuss some of the issues around a sugar tax. I was joined by Jane Martin, who's Executive Manager of the Obesity Policy Coalition, which is a coalition of Cancer Council Victoria, Diabetes Victoria and Deakin University. Nick Talley, who's Editor-in-Chief of the Medical Journal of Australia and Pro-Vice Chancellor of Global Research at the University of Newcastle. Alexandra Jones, who's a public health lawyer and researcher at the George Institute for Global Health at the University of New South Wales. And Rob Moody, who's Professor of Public Health at the University of Malawi and the University of Melbourne. And the discussion began with Ali Jones outlining the international evidence for a sugar tax.
I think what we know, and we know this well from tobacco, is that price influences consumption. At the international level, we have a lot of recommendations now from the World Health Organization and a growing consensus that we could use these sorts of price measures effectively on food as well. And I think they're going after the nutrients that we consume the most of first and where we think we could have the biggest impact.
So we'll come to that in a moment. Now, Rob Moody, price did work with tobacco. I mean, price was one important mechanism for actually controlling tobacco use.
Did work and does work. Probably the key factor. I mean, you need a combined group of strategies, advertising bans, you need smoke-free regulations, but price has been the key driver of reducing tobacco. And we've seen that now, in, not only in Australia, in many high-income countries, but we're now starting to introduce that in places like Laos, Vietnam, Thailand, and the Philippines, and it's starting to work.
So how much do you have to put up the dial on price to get what sort of reduction in use?
I can't actually don't have that. Jane might remember, but I mean, certainly you need to do it enough. In other words, in Australia, we put up the, I think in WHO, you have to have at least 70% of the price is tax. And in Australia, it's more, much, much more. But we've introduced in 2010 the price by 25%. Then in 2000, I think 14, 15, 16, 12.5% each year. So we know plain packaging has been a very important part of reducing our smoking prevalence in Australia, but price has been the key determinant.
In all groups in the population or just people who are most price sensitive, in other words, the poor?
We know that adolescents and low income are more sensitive to price, and that's across the board, just not with tobacco taxes. But they're the groups who have the highest smoking prevalence, and they have the most to gain.
Yeah, and that's often why people will argue against the tax. They say, well, it's retrogressive, it'll hurt the poor most. Well, the point is, as we've seen with tobacco, if you can get those that have least income actually to give up, they can use that money for much healthier alternatives.
So, Jane, one of the arguments with tobacco and alcohol and all other drugs is that if you're not using drugs irresponsibly or badly or in an unhealthy way by the age of about 20, you're unlikely to. Therefore, you do target adolescents. To what extent, and we'll come to more specifics about a sugar tax or a fat tax later, to what extent is it the same story with obesogenic food?
Well, we know that sugar does have an impact on the brain. It does excite the pleasure centre of the brain. We know that these products are very heavily, high sugar products are heavily marketed to young people and they develop their tastes when they're young, particularly for sweetness. And we know that adolescents in particular are very high consumers of sugary drinks, particularly boys, and are way exceeding the World Health Organization guidelines. But also very young children are starting to drink these drinks very, very early. And that's something that we haven't seen before either. So it's a huge source of added sugar in the diet. There's no benefit from this. The dental health implications are really serious. And our dental health is very poor in our children as a result of that. So it's a good place to start with young people to prevent dental disease and prevent them going on to develop overweight and obesity and the associated diseases.
So, Nick Talley, does the medical profession have a position on this?
Well, certainly the Council of Presidents of Medical Colleges had a summit about obesity. And one of the issues that was clearly flagged was the need for financial incentives to create an effective strategy and to start really early and with the whole family. And that means prevention, really almost preconception and further on as children are born. So the whole family's engaged.
And so if you talk to industry about this, I mean, so for example, you take Drinkwise, which is an alcohol-funded thing, they'll say they'll spend anything they like or not. And they say, just educate people. You know, tell them that they shouldn't be doing it and we'll give you all the money in the world to do that. Presumably that's because they know it doesn't work.
Well, there's not a lot of evidence that education alone does a lot in this space. And this was reviewed by the summit. Others may have an opinion here, but certainly the evidence that I've seen and the evidence that I've been told all suggests education alone will fail, guaranteed.
Because you can ask the average mum of almost any socioeconomic grouping, they know what they shouldn't be eating.
I suspect some of them do. Many of them do. Think
Jane?
So.
We've had a Live Lighter campaign being run in a number of states and territories in Australia, and one of them is around sugary drink consumption. And in fact, that has been very successful. We think people know sugary drinks are bad, that they contribute to overweight and obesity, that they make you fat, and people don't know that. And when they do have that information and they are drinking those drinks, they slow down and stop. So these kinds
of... So we don't need a sugar tax?
We do, because we need to accelerate this. We need to do both.
I think the point is that education is necessary but not sufficient.
Absolutely.
And we have in tobacco, it's in the global treaty that what you need, what the gold standard is a comprehensive approach. So we need the education, we need the health stars we've got, we need the dietary guidelines, but a tax would be another simple and powerful step.
Changing behaviour is really hard. You know, ingrained behaviour doesn't change easily. You need multiple incentives, a multi-pronged approach. That's why education doesn't work terribly well.
I mean, we've spent 30 years, well, 30 or 40 years gradually, surreptitiously, strategically increasing the average consumption of sugar for the average Australian. I mean, to the point of where it's very dangerous now. We know all those. So, I mean, just as you can ramp this up, you can also ramp it down. And you can actually ramp it down without people knowing, because there's so much. I mean, if you take a bottle of one particular barbecue sauce, it's got over 100 teaspoons of sugar in it. The average person will not know that, you know, there's 10 teaspoons of sugar in their Coke. Imagine if you saw them in a coffee shop and they've got their cappuccino and they're tipping in 10 teaspoons of sugar. You'd think, my goodness, they're nuts. This problem is fundamentally still hidden. And
so let's just get the elephant out of the room for the moment. In terms of the obesity epidemic, as we call it, to the extent to which, you know, so people are thinking, well, it is just, you know, nobody ever got fat in Belsen. It's what they put in their mouth. They should just control it. And there's no role for the state here. What's the argument against that?
Well, I think the issue is that the industry are driving demand and consumption, and it's in their interest to do that. Highly processed foods, many of which are high in sugar, are very cheap to produce. There's a very high profit margin. You try and find an apple in a car parking station or an airport, it's much easier to find a packet of chips and a soft drink. And we're surrounded by advertising, marketing, promotion of these foods. We've just seen the Apples come in and sponsor the women's netball. That is a rare, rare example. You know, what we've just had a summer of the Big Bash League, brought to you by fried chicken and frozen sugary drinks. And that's directed to children and families. So we are absolutely surrounded by levers which push us in the opposite direction of a healthy diet. And we're driven by price, the type of products these are, and the promotion of these products. And they're so available. They're everywhere.
And Nick Talley, you know, there's something physiological going on here. You know, the research here in Melbourne, Joe Peretta's group, have shown that by the time you're in adolescence, if you're fat or obese, you've changed the hormones in your brain. Childhood obesity is actually important for the rest of your life.
You change your brain, you change your gut bacteria. There are physiological changes that then stay with you. And unfortunately, they reinforce the behaviours of eating more sugary and high-fat foods. And that's what happens.
So let's go back to the question I asked at the beginning. But before we get to specific countries, Ali, as a lawyer, give me the spectrum of how this has been put in place around the world before we find out what results they've got. What are the legal change? What are the legislative changes or regulatory changes that people have tried out?
We have countries experimenting with a variety of taxes, and they can do that in different ways depending on their own tax system. But I think what they're doing is fundamentally they're saying, we want to change the price of something, and they're very careful about the objectives. And we did this with plain packaging in Australia. So you say, we're going to single out a product that we have enough evidence to link this particular product with some harm. So sugary drinks is a good example of that. And then we're going to say, this measure will decrease consumption, it would decrease the purchasing, and it will increase awareness of the health risks. What they won't say is that a measure like that would overall impact obesity, because that's very hard to show. So they pick these little measures and they pick things that we can measure that it will impact and say that this measure together with a range of measures is going to work.
In terms of reducing consumption of that particular group of products.
Yeah, and that is part of and they'll frame that as part of a strategy to improve diets.
And what have they had to put in place to be, so is it a tax? What is it?
Yeah, it's a tax. So in Mexico, it's a 10% tax. It gets passed on to the consumer. So the price, effectively the consumer pays 10% more. But that's actually quite low. We think that it would be better to be at least 20%. That's what the WHO is recommending.
But presumably that will vary from country to country. You're going to have to get your setting right. So there's a bit of experimentation that needs to go on.
There is. And some countries like the UK has done quite an interesting design where they're putting a varying tax depending on the sugar content of the product. And the purpose of that is to incentivize companies to reformulate their product. So what you already see before the tax is coming in is like the Scottish drink Iron Brew, for example.
I remember it well.
They've already announced that they're going...
Many fillings in my mouth are caused by Iron Brew.
Well, they've already announced that they're going to cut the sugar in that product by half. So obviously still sweet, but...
I was on your side until you told me that.
In one foul swoop, you've just removed a whole lot of sugar from the food supply. So without any individual having to do something, you've just changed the food supply.
Okay, and is there a trade-off? So what I've heard discussed is that, so for example, if you're Coca-Cola and you're going to put a 20% hike on Coke, you get a lower tax, or you make it cheaper to buy Coke Zero, to use brand names. Is that in place so that, in fact, the manufacturer doesn't lose out, that there's a trade-off in products?
That is in place. So this tax only applies to the high-sugar products, and it doesn't apply to the diet drinks or water. And, I mean, interestingly, Coca-Cola's just cut the price of their water because water sales have increased in Australia and they're competing for the market share. So they understand price influences consumption.
Absolutely. So the argument is then that the barbecue sauce might be a different matter. They might have to change the sugar content. But, you know, in soft drinks, they might actually come out even Steven. Because the sales go down in their sugar drinks, but go up in their
other
products.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's in a sense what's being encouraged. I mean, the way that you shift consumption patterns and the more that this sort of forms of regulation, the companies will respond. They know how the market works. They know how sensitive people are to prices. So the more that we can actually encourage to push them in healthier and healthier directions, just as we can encourage people in vending machines to put the really sugary drinks at the bottom.
So why are the sugary drink manufacturers putting the wagon train in a circle and fighting this?
Well, I mean, it's interesting when you look at any forms of suggested regulation, any government approaches to this, there's fundamentally a view that says government does not have a role in what we eat or drink. Regulation is a bad thing of any form. And what we've found over the last 40 years, and it comes from the Merchants of Doubt book by Naomi Oreskes, is that the enemies of regulation have become the enemies of science. And that's where we are here.
So what you're talking about is they cast doubt on the evidence.
Absolutely. And they will cast also doubt on the researchers themselves as well as the evidence.
I think there's a fear it'll be successful. And I think that means that actually, eventually they will lose a little bit of money. And I think there's a real fear within corporations, at least the ones I've spoken to, that that may be the case. And that's the worry, that it may actually work and work really well. Mm. But in terms of health benefit and in terms, frankly, of the community's interests, this is important and needs to be seriously considered by the politicians.
But presumably the wagon train's in a circle because sugar's the first step, then it's fat or saturated fat.
It could be.
So, Jane, take us through the country, what you know about the countries that have put this into place and the sort of results that they've got.
Sure. So
the Merchants of Doubt have said, well, it doesn't work.
Exactly.
So
in a very black and white way, they've said that the changes in Mexico haven't worked. That's absolutely not true. We have really good evidence. This has been evaluated very, very carefully because it's a testing ground for the rest of the world. Proof of concept is being formed there. And what they found is in the last 2 years, overall, the consumption of sugary drinks with the 10% tax has gone down by 7.6%. And the decline has been highest in low-income groups, and they're the very groups who are suffering the most from this epidemic. So it's really supporting them to change their diets and drink less sugar.
So that's interesting. It's about the same ratio as tobacco, you know, in terms of the tax and the reduction in consumption.
And Berkeley have a 20% tax. It's a retail tax. And that's seen decline.
Berkeley in California.
Yes. Mm. And that's seen much, much greater declines, around, I think, 26% declines. So that's really significant changes in a population that will flow through to health outcomes.
And what's happened in the UK?
The UK, well, as Ali said, they are putting a tax to encourage reformulation, so the tax is on the manufacturer, and we've already seen huge changes. It's created a lot of public discussion, so already people are understanding that sugary drinks are an issue for their health and reducing consumption, and then we've seen the manufacturers, Tesco, have changed all their products, Lucozade, Ribena. These are iconic drink brands.
Iron Brew.
I can't say that as well as you, but the sugar levels in all those drinks are already coming down. And so the estimated earnings for the tax office have already been reduced.
Some people say, well, we should trade off and the earnings should actually go to health. And some people say, no, you should actually put the earnings from this into other areas to make more healthy products more attractive. And in other words, you actually manipulate the market a little bit using the taxes. What should happen to the windfall?
Well, one of the things you might want to do is to actually buy out the sponsorships.
Now, we should say here that Rob Moody used to be the CEO of the Victorian Health Promotion Foundation, now known as Vic Health, which did just that.
Exactly. And if you look at some of the biggest opponents to this sort of approach in Australia, it's the Cricket Australia, it's the big football codes, because the kings of Australian sport are the ambassadors of sugar and the ambassadors of booze and the ambassadors of gambling. It's not a really good look. And I think that the punter always pays for the sponsorship, because either through buying the product themselves or through a hypothecator or a dedicated tax, we pay for it. It's much more sensible when we are paying that percentage of the cost that goes into a sponsorship, that it goes into a good sponsorship.
So you've got a situation in Australia. Let's start talking about how you implement this in the Australian environment. So you've got a situation in Australia where the crossbenchers hold the balance of power in the Senate, very hard to pass legislation. One Nation's got a lot of senators there. That last week they held up legislation to get a code of conduct for the sugar industry in Queensland. It's not just Queensland, it's also northern New South Wales. And you've got a Liberal Party hostage to the right wing who are going to say this is the nanny state and the government's got no place to be here. Let's start with the sugar farmers. Rob, tell me, we were a big producer of tobacco. And when people were saying we should be taxing tobacco and stopping that, there was a big lobby from the tobacco farmers in Australia. I haven't heard from the tobacco farmers for a while. What happened?
They don't exist.
Well, yeah. Did they all go bankrupt? Did they chip crop? What happened to them?
Yeah.
Well,
Jane, you know more than Rob. Yeah, you go.
She knows a lot more than me.
Well, what happened was the revenue raised from an increased excise in tobacco tax. Some of that money was set aside to support the tobacco growers to shift to other products, to grow other products. So there was a scheme developed to help them transition. They're in very rich alluvial soil in valleys.
As indeed are sugarcane farmers. Mm.
And so, you know, that's a good prospect for a farmer who wants to grow produce. You know, if everybody ate all the recommended amount of fruit and veg, we don't grow enough for people to do that. So, you know, let's promote fresh fruit and vegetables and let's move that land over to something that will improve people's health in the longer
term. But with a lower margin.
Well, it may not, no, because, I mean, tobacco growing, for example, is not terribly good way of earning an income. It's really brutal for the tobacco farmers. I mean, I think probably you'll find the sugar farmers' income is far more dependent on global pricing and global markets than it is on anything that a sugar tax in Australia could ever impact on.
Ali, you were telling me a little bit about the structure of the sugar market and where it goes from sugarcane farmers here.
Yeah, I think what we know, and this was in the Grattan Institute report that came out last year on this, was that about 80%, at least 80% of the sugar grown by Australian farmers is actually exported. And so then if you consider what is left here and remains in use for all the other uses, so, you know, packets of sugar in the supermarket and different
barbecue
products.
Barbecue sauce.
Rum.
Australian Iron Brew.
Sweet yogurts. But sugary drinks is likely to be quite a small percentage. And so the impact of a small price change on those products, not a big impact on that industry.
Right. You can stand up and say that in the Australian Parliament. So how what's the process forward? Well, actually, before I get to that process forward, I really, by the way, you're listening to The Health Report here on ABC Radio National, ABC News Radio and CBC Radio across Canada. And we're talking about sugar tax, if you haven't tweaked that already. My name is Norman Swan. My guests are Jane Martin from the Obesity Policy Coalition in Victoria, Nick Talley, who's Editor-in-Chief of the Medical Journal of Australia and also Pro Vice-Chancellor of Global Research at the University of Newcastle, Ali Jones, who's a public health lawyer at the George Institute for Global Health in Sydney, and Rob Moody, who spends his life between Malawi and Melbourne, Professor of Public Health at the University of Malawi and the University of Melbourne. Fat tax? Is anybody doing that? Does it work? I mean, let's assume that we've got the sugar tax in place. What happens next? Because that, as you said right at the beginning, Ali, or halfway through, you said, well, you're going to take individual products, see where that matters and hope that it makes a difference, but you're not necessarily going to show that you can shift the dial on obesity until you actually deal with all the empty calories, you know, a lot of the empty calories on the shelf. Anybody doing a fat tax?
Denmark has done a fat tax, and the sugary drink industry and others in Australia say it didn't work. It did, in fact, work, but it got knocked off because of the opposition. There was a lot of scaremongering done by industry. They worked very, very hard. And
Lurpak butter got them in the end.
It was to reduce heart disease. So it was designed as...
So it was a saturated fat tax.
It was a saturated fat tax designed to reduce heart disease, not overweight and obesity, because that was the problem in that country.
I think the thing we can learn from Denmark is a few lessons on how not to implement a fat tax, but not necessarily that it's a bad idea, but just that there are difficulties in defining the product, setting the tax at a high enough amount to make a difference, and then defending. There was a change of government there, so I think there are a lot of factors that played into why the tax was set aside before it really had a chance to work.
So just give us a few more details about how they did it.
They put it on popular high saturated fat products. So it was put on...
So high-fat dairy?
Yeah, high-fat dairy, some meat products, but the high-fat meat products like sausages and high-fat processed meat. So high-fat yogurts, things like that. So they were quite careful as to how they set it up, and they looked at what people were actually eating and what was causing the greatest issues. So they were careful with that, but they had a problem with cross-border. But what they found was when they evaluated it...
The European community problems.
Well, they've got borders. We're an island, so we don't get the sort of the smuggling type situation. So we're kind of protected from that to some degree. But people did eat less saturated fat. It did have the intended consequence.
In a very short time. I mean, this is what was quite staggering in Denmark. It was such a short time, and they could even tell a difference in that short time. So that's why it is actually important to be very specific about what the tax is, what the expected impacts are, and that we can actually measure them. And even then, with good evidence, it's how we can actually explain the evidence back to the political decision makers and to the community, because often it will be completely distorted by vested interest. I mean, that's their job. Their job is to make money out of their products, and they will fight for their right to do so.
So when all these things happened in these various countries, fat taxes in Denmark, you know, sugar taxes in California and Mexico and so on, how did it actually happen? Was it just, you know, guerrilla action, you know, public conversations, a prime minister or a president who cared? What was the story?
Well, I think in a country like Mexico, diabetes is just such an enormous problem, and sugary drink consumption is incredibly high. You know, you have these companies sponsoring schools, for example. It's very much embedded in the population's diet. And so it was the epidemic of diabetes, which is incredibly expensive for such a poor country to manage. And so they had this out of control public health issue that was very well described by the medical community, and that advocacy, it began quite some time ago, but the very much engaged with civil society. They had quite a strong campaign, not just around sugary drinks, but around advertising and marketing and a suite of actions that need to happen by government. It's because the campaign really focused on the burden on families and children, were very much engaged in this as well. So it was very much about a community response to a really serious public health issue.
And from go to war? I mean, how long did it take from the early conversations to implement?
Several years. It's interesting when you look historically at most of the really effective public health interventions, then there's been an enormous amount of build-up to building the pressure, building the evidence, building community support for this, trying to get senior decision-makers on side, and then there'll be a tipping point. In road trauma, in seatbelts, it was actually...
It was the College of Surgeons.
Well, yeah, they built the pressure, but it was actually Rupert Hamer taking Arthur Ryler, the number two in charge, he was the deputy premier, out to the Austin, to the spinal unit, and David Burke showed them through and said, there are 40 people here, none of them would be here if we had seatbelts. That convinced Ryler to convince Henry Bolte to bring it in. I mean, with Vic Health, it was Nigel Gray talking to David White. David White's dad had emphysema. Nicola Roxon's dad, same thing. You know, it's an issue where you can get key leadership twitches, changes at certain points, but you
when
have
the time
to have
is
that.
Right. The
but you've got to have that consequence. That's when people say to me, "Oh, there's no hope of a sugar tax at the moment." I'm saying, "I'm sorry, I'm here for the long haul." I mean, we are 60 years since we knew that tobacco causes lung cancer. Still, 40% of 13 to 15 year old Indonesian boys smoke. You know, it takes time to win these battles.
But we have a health crisis in Australia that's under-recognised. The diabetes health crisis is just under-recognised. And yet it's a real problem for public hospitals, for general practitioners, for families, for the entire community. And it's time we did something about it rather than sitting on our hands saying it's all too hard or we'll leave it up to industry to make a decision about our health. And it's not a sugar tax we need. It's a health tax.
And we're all paying for it in the meantime.
So, Nick, will the medical profession put their shoulders to the wheel?
Well, I'm reasonably confident they will, actually. The Council of Presidents of all the medical colleges met with experts and with industry and with representatives of all sorts of groups to talk about this last year. I was amazed there was agreement in the room about moving forward and the profession should be leading by example. Good. That's a remarkable shift, I think, a very good shift. But we need more than the profession.
Well, and they made a big difference. I mean, the agitators for smoking, for tobacco control.
And road trauma.
Used the AMA, the College of Surgeons and so on, College of Physicians.
But also the media, the churches. I mean, there are other groups we've just got to bring on side.
Going to get the lawyers on, Ali?
Yeah.
The lawyers will be here to design the law, to make it
smart. They win every time.
And then also to defend it in the case of that it's challenged. I mean, lawyers in plain packaging has been there's a huge role for lawyers there.
Well, let's hope that the lawyers, the public health people, the community and everybody else gets together on this. Jane Martin is Executive Manager of the Obesity Policy Coalition in Victoria. Nick Talley is Editor-in-Chief of the Medical Journal of Australia. Ali Jones is a public health lawyer at the George Institute for Global Health at the University of New South Wales. And Rob Moody is Professor of Public Health at the Universities of Malawi and Melbourne. You've been listening to one of the Health Report's highlights of the year, and we hope you can join me next week for the next one.